Okay, thank you. My name's Christine Birch, and this is my submission on the rural visitor zone. I've read the Section 42A report prepared by Ms Grace, and although it brings more scrutiny to this chapter, the amended chapter still does not provide enough certainty or guidance to effectively limit the extent and effects of the very permissive proposed rural visitor zone. The majority of the Queenstown Lakes community considers tourism has reached its limit and the district should not become more dependent on tourism. Other industries should be explored. So I question whether further tourism industry development should be facilitated by the proposed zone. In determining what are suitable rural sites, visitor sites, there is a focus on landscape values but little else. The proposed landscape sensitivity and capacity assessment seems complicated, subjective, somewhat contrived and sure to be contentious. It is contrary to the ONL/F assessment matters whereby development is inappropriate in almost all locations and successful only if exceptional. There is no assessment determining how the various permitted commercial activities or informal airports bringing people, noise and traffic will impact the amenity, for example privacy, peace and quiet of surrounding sites. Furthermore, all the activities considered within the Chapter 46 have already been considered and provided for as part of the review of all other zones and objectives, policies, activity status and rules decided for them. There is no compelling reason given for why the rural visitor zone should override these other zonings. There is no imperative for the rural visitor zone. It is superfluous, and rather than clarifying and giving certainty to planning, it opens a can of worms by trying to combine various disparate and dispersed sites as a zone. For these reasons, I submit that the Chapter 46 should be deleted from the plan. Visitor industry activities and all their effects, not just those on landscape, are better scrutinised and considered alongside other activities against the provisions of the underlying zones. I am a neighbour of Matakari Lodge and the owners have requested that their site be rezoned as rural visitor zone. It is my view that the rural visitor zone should be deleted, but if it persists, Matakari should not be rezoned rural visitor zone. The site is neither remote nor difficult to see from public places as required by policy 46.2.1. With regard to the Matakari Lodge request, Ms Grace says a high-level landscape analysis has been undertaken and that the site generally has the key characteristics for a rural visitor zone area, a degree of remoteness and it's difficult to see from the road, although she notes it is visible from the lake. She considers that rural visitor zone is more appropriate zone than the rural lifestyle zone, but does not go so far as recommend rezoning unless a landscape assessment has been undertaken. Ms Grace states that the building size and density rules are stricter in the rural visitor zone than the rural lifestyle zone. However, the operative district plan includes a site standard limiting non-residential and non-rural building areas to 100 square metres, but this has been ignored by Queenstown Lakes District Council in granting Matakari approximately 2,000 total ground floor area of visitor accommodation buildings, plus another 400 odd square metres of covered decks. Ms Grace suggests that whether or not the Matakari site is rezoned rural visitor zone depends largely on a landscape assessment. This is a very blinkered and inadequate approach. It looks only at the Matakari site and does not consider the impacts of the commercial activities permitted by the rural visitor zone with no control on its neighbours in the surrounding zone. Furthermore, landscape assessments are too subjective to be useful or to be the basis for rezoning. For example, with respect to the large owner's cottage on the Matakari site, landscape architect Michael Stevens, at the hearing for that building, concludes, "It is my opinion that the effects of the proposed development are more than minor and the development is contrary to the objectives and policies of the plan. I regard the proposed lodge development and indeed the existing lodge complex to be an inappropriate development in this location. The development is inconsistent with the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values associated with the anticipated rural living experience and of neighbours and of recreational users of the adjacent trail, the beach, public jetty and nearby waters of Lake Wakatipu. Concerning the same development, landscape architect Rebecca Lucas in her evidence at the same hearing concludes, I consider the visual effects of the proposed building assessed individually or cumulatively will not be adverse. Rural amenity values of the neighbours will be maintained. The stakes are too high to rely on subjective landscape reports to decide whether or not to rezone a site as rural visitor zone. Ms. Grace sees the site as remote, but it is not remote from its neighbours. I note Ms. Lucas in her evidence for this hearing states our residence is 62 metres from the nearest boundary. However, we have a residential unit 10.5 metres from the site boundary. Why is Ms. Grace not concerned for the effects of traffic noise, helicopter nuisance, patrons of restaurants, bars and commercial recreation, deliveries etc. on neighbours of the Matakari site and others in the surrounding rural lifestyle zone and the loss of amenity that will cause? Is she aware that under the rural lifestyle zone, commercial visitor accommodation is discretionary and commercial activities are non-complying? Chapter 46 quite clearly recognises that the rural visitor zone is not compatible with residential activity. So surely it is not appropriate to locate a rural visitor zone within a residential area. Matakari has engaged Ms. Lucas to provide a landscape assessment of their site. In her evidence, that's another assessment, sorry. Ms. Lucas in her evidence states that the Matakari site is within the ONL, which is interesting. As in her evidence for the owner's cottage hearing, she stated it was not. There, she concedes that the existing Matakari Lodge development has changed the character of the area. The area is clearly different from the surrounding more natural mountains and lake, where development is less concentrated, and if it does exist, is more difficult to see or not visible at all. For the reasons above, I consider the site should not be classified as an ONL. So it seems that landscape assessments are subjective and some landscape architects are fickle. The assessment is completely inward-looking. For example, Ms. Lucas mentions the darkness at night due to the very few visible surrounding lights adds to the sense of isolation. She neglects to say that the residents above Matakari Lodge, in particular the Forest Hill and Corsican Cove subdivisions, look down on the many lights from Matakari Lodge and for this reason have made submissions against Matakari's development. Ms. Lucas states the planting successfully absorbs the lodge development into the surrounding landscape. But what exactly does this mean? The buildings are still there and clearly visible from houses above the site, especially Forest Line, Corsican Cove and Forest Line subdivisions, the Petit residence, Lake Wakatipu, the Glenorchy Queenstown Road and the very popular Department of Conservation 7 Mile car park and walking track. I note that Ms. Lucas acknowledges Matakari is visible from the lake on page 13, but says it's not visible from the Glenorchy Queenstown Road, the 7 Mile reservoir track, but this is obviously a mistake. She states the site is modified but has retained a remote, wild, scenic and peaceful character with a high level of isolation and wildness. I dispute that the site is either remote or wild. But what Ms. Lucas doesn't state is the very characteristics Matakari relies on to provide its quiet, peaceful, remote character and birdsong largely arise from its location within the rural lifestyle zone. If all sites were as developed as Matakari, providing accommodation for 32 guests, public dining, public spa, car parks, functions, large wastewater disposal fields, so on, the attributes the Matakari rely on and promote as their own would be lost. Matakari is quick to take advantage of the benefits of the rural lifestyle zone, but opposed to contributing to these. Rezoning Matakari as rural visitor zone does not remove the site from the rural lifestyle zone. The reason for having zones and applying standards is not to protect the site that develops, but to provide certainty for and to protect the rest of the zone, and in particular, the developing site's immediate neighbours. It's useful to consider what Matakari and Queenstown Lakes District Council have written previously on relevant matters and the contradictions and fickleness therein. The QLDC Section 32 Evaluation Report, Matakari Lodge, which evaluated the visitor accommodation subzone, written by largely by Tim Williams from Southern Planning Group, states that the current Metacarry development is well beyond what is allowed within the rural lifestyle zone, and that any further development is uncertain and likely to be costly. I agree with Mr. Williams. The Metacarry development is far in excess of what QLDC should have consented within the rural lifestyle zone. And regarding certainty, as neighbours of Metacarry, we also want certainty that the zone will be upheld and rural amenity maintained. Metacarry Lodge was bought in 2009 with the owners knowing full well that it was in a rural lifestyle zone and the level of development this allowed. But this is not the certainty Metacarry is seeking. They are seeking certainty of further development. Mr. Williams goes on to evaluate the declined subzone against two other options, the status quo and rezoning the rural visitor zone, rezoning the site to rural visitor zone. Mr. Williams dismisses the rural visitor zone as inappropriate. He says, the rural visitor zone would enable a greater range of activity, commercial activity is provided for in the RV zone, that would potentially create a level activity out of character with the surrounding area. He says it would not recognise the amenity and character of the area, given the intensity of development it enables. Amenity to neighbours may be compromised, given the intensity of form and form of development that would be enabled. I agree with Mr. Williams. Applying a rural visitor zone to a single site within the rural lifestyle zone is way out of step with the zone and would significantly reduce the amenity of the surrounding area. Metacarry want to rezone their site to allow development that bypasses the scrutiny of the resource consent process. This is certainly not a justification for a subzone, let alone rezoning. Mr. Craig Barr, in his Section 42 report for Chapter 22 hearing, is quite clear that commercial activities should not be enabled or readily contemplated in the rural lifestyle zone. And I agree with Mr. Barr. Commercial activities, as would be allowed in the rural visitor zone, will conflict with rural living. The Section 32 evaluation for visitor accommodation variation describes the adverse effects of visitor accommodation in residential areas, including traffic and parking, effects on residential amenities such as noise and nuisance effects generated by visitor movements, and the general erosion of residential cohesion and character. The report proposes objectives for residential areas to restrict intensive commercial visitor accommodation in predominantly residential environments. This report also mentions spot zoning with regard to visitor accommodation subzones, recommending an approach to generally prevent very small subzones or single parcel subzones which result in spot zoning. I note that the author of this report incorrectly assumes that Metacarry site is already zoned visitor accommodation subzone. It is not. Rezoning the Metacarry site as rural visitor zone flies in the face of the intent of this report. It is clear that a single site zoned rural visitor zone within a residential zone will lead to significant adverse effects on the surrounding properties. Also relevant is the Commissioner's report on the proposed Metacarry visitor accommodation subzone. The Commissioners note that the only resource management issue addressed by the report in considering this proposal was the administrative cost of further development and were critical that there was no proper evaluation made of the effects of applying the proposed rules on the environment surrounding the three visitor accommodation subzones. Their recommendation was to delete the proposed subzone because if visitor accommodation buildings were given a controlled activity status, there would be no opportunity to refuse them. And only by having the ability to refuse consent would council be able to achieve the policies of the proposed district plan when considering applications for visitor accommodation in the subzones. Instead, the commissioners recommended that visitor accommodation should occur where the overall qualities of the relevant zone are retained and the scale and intensity of the development is consistent with that anticipated by the zone outside of any subzone. Mr. Barr, QLD planner, concurs, stating in his evidence that although these areas contemplate visitor accommodation, the scale and intensity should be commensurate with the zone it is located in. Oh, I've got two sentences. All right. I agree with the Commissioner's decision and believe the same applies to the Rural Visitor Zone. All the activities in the Rural Visitor Zone have already been considered and included in the Rural Lifestyle Zone as appropriate. Why do they need to be revisited? And why exactly should the QLDC arrange the district plan so that the Matakari Lodge site can continue to be developed to the Rural Lifestyle Zone? Contrary to the Rural Lifestyle Zone. Matakari's development ambitions must fit the zone, not the other way around. Yes, so my first submission was that there wasn't enough guidance on the chapter, and so the council's gone away and tried to provide that, but reading the section 42 report and the revised chapter, I don't think they've been able to do that.
Can you point to any particular aspects of their amended zone provisions? Has relied on your submission, I think, to try and tighten up, I think, the provisions of the zone, both the zone purpose and the objectives and policies.
Yes.
And I mean, I noticed your name is beside some of the amendments she's made.
I'm sure I wasn't the only one.
No, but she mentions your submission has been helpful in that regard. But have you got any comments on what, on where she, you don't think she's gone far enough, or where she's watered
I think I just think what they're trying to do by justifying development in the ONLs and the ONFs is it's not going to work, basically. I think that's very complicated. And how are they going to choose these sites that are low sensitivity. Yes. Are they going to look at the whole of the Queenstown Lakes district and then pick out the sites, or are they going to just react to how, you know, these people that make submissions? And, you know, what is an ONL? I thought they were, I mean, they were areas where development wasn't to be contemplated except in very exceptional circumstances, but all these submissions that have been made, I just don't think that they are exceptional. I mean, we have existing places like Walter Peak and Blanket Bay, so why not just let them stand? But I think in trying to make a zone out of those areas, I just think it's not going to work.
One thing I asked Ms. Grace about was changing the word remote to generally remote. Have you got any comment on that?
Well, what is remote?
Or generally remote.
What is generally remote? I mean, Ms. Lucas says that the Matakari site is remote. So if she can say that's remote, then what is remote? I think it's too... Walter Peak and Blanket Bay, Walter Peak, you get on a boat and you go there. I mean, that's, I think, is maybe remote. And Blanket Bay, you don't see the lodge from the... You only see it from the lake or across the lake on the road to Kingston. Maybe they're remote, but I don't know. I mean, I think this whole thing is fraught.
That, by hand, is the issue, because
Yes.
And so then it becomes the definition of remote. And one of the things, and I'd be interested in your view on the purpose to it's basically facilitating access to remote locations and what are your thoughts on it?
So you think this zone is to facilitate access to remote locations?
No, I'm saying that's one of the tools to put it.
Facilitating access to the outstanding landscapes of the district or something like that. But again, it's the same difficulties that you're feeling.
Yes.
Raising. Sorry, did I interrupt you? You are right. Just a more practical thing. You're saying, because I noticed that you say that the Matahari Lodge development is visible from the 7 mile car park and from some of the trails associated with that?
From the top of the trail near the car park,
near the car park, yes. And from the state highway as well?
Yes, you can catch glimpses of it along the road, especially at night, you see all the lights.
And you're saying some of those subdivisions further up, the
above, look down.
See the lights.
Yeah, well, they do see the lights.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think you've been very helpful.
Thank you.
I have a similar question, but just on a technical sense, one of the issues that we raise in relation to Matakawa is the traffic and the access. Have you got any experience? Can you give us any insights in terms of traffic? Think about the intersection.
The intersection on the main road?
Yes.
Well, just about the right-of-way itself. In the summer, when Matakari is busy, nearly every time that we leave our house and drive out, we'll meet some vehicle, and it maybe takes us a minute to drive out. So obviously there is a lot of traffic. And the intersection, you know, sometimes when it's busy and the Glenorchy Road is busy in the summer, there is a lot of cars. There can be three cars at the intersection.
I mean, I understand, but how often do you see sort of the smaller buses bringing people here, which seem to be more of a greater concern of small buses taking people to the lodge, particularly in our gap?
You mean like the those little black minibus things that take people on tours and stuff?
Well, I'm just understanding how people get to it. I think most people drive there, but
yes, like I can't remember what those are called, but those little black vans that are with dark windows that drive around, I can't remember what they are.
Do you in terms of just living here and having to seeing what's being described as difficult access in and out of the highway?
Well, if you look at the highway, you'll see that quite often the trucks scrape the tar seal. I mean, there is a lot of... the Glenorchy Road in the summer is very busy, as you know, so the intersection can get busy. But, thank you. Do you want a copy of Mod I read out?
Morning. Thank you. My name's Andrew McLennan. I'm a consultant planner working for the ORC, and I'm here with Dr. Ben McKay, who is a natural hazard analyst for the ORC, and we are here to speak about the variation to Chapter 30. Our evidence was relatively self-explanatory, so we can take you briefly through the highlights and then respond to any questions. The ORC submission supported the majority of the variation with some minor amendments, as noted in my evidence. The proposed variation is of the utmost importance to the ORC's ability to control natural hazard risks within the district. This is highlighted in Dr. McKay's evidence, which has noted a number of areas in the district where natural hazard mitigation works are required within ONLs, ONFs. As a real-world example, ORC are currently looking at options to manage a slip in Albert Town, and consenting of these works will be assisted greatly by the provisions within the proposed variation. In my opinion, the proposed variation strikes the right balance between protecting sensitive areas of the district and enabling natural hazard mitigation. There were four areas where the ORC submission sought changes to the PDP, all of which I consider have been resolved by the Section 42A amendments and the evidence exchange. I can take you through those, but given that I largely agree with Mr. Barr, maybe that's not worth it. Okay. Excellent. Thank you. I can hand over to Ben to provide you a bit of an overview of the areas within which ORC manage natural hazards within ONLs and ONFs, if you like, if you're... Excellent. Sure.
Good morning. My evidence is pretty straightforward. It's just highlighting a couple of existing areas where we have fairly major infrastructure, for natural hazard mitigation at Albert Town and on the Shotover River Delta, and just a handful of other sites where infrastructure may be considered in the future. I suppose the key takeaway is that the stunning landscapes in this district, they aren't frozen, they're still evolving, particularly around things like big rivers. So there is a need to potentially act to manage and mitigate the natural hazard risk at some of these locations.
My understanding of tolerability within the RPS and also going through the mediations on the PDP, it's a community tolerance, so it's not something that is landowner established. How you get there, I suppose, is where the rubber meets the road. Yeah, that's certainly something that was grappled with when we were going through some of the mediations, and there was some new policy introduced on what a significant risk was and how you would assess what tolerability was, and they've been included in Chapter 28. So that, I suppose, provides some guidance as to how that is to occur, but it's still... not the easiest concept to manage case by case.
And so what's your answer to the philosophical question? Why should the community worry if the individual is happy with sacrifice?
I suppose there's a few points to that, in that if if one individual is happy to tolerate a risk, it might not be the same tolerance if you were to sell that property on to someone else. That's, I suppose, the overarching risk. There's also, I suppose, the risk that if one person's happy to tolerate risk, but then an event happens and that the cleanup is wider than just that individual, I suppose the community is potentially up for the cost of some of the risk that was taken on by an individual. So that's why I think the RPS has sought that it's community tolerability rather than individual tolerability for those reasons. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am. Yeah, that's partially right, sir. So I am here for Arthur's Point Woods Limited, and Mr. Freeman is my planner. Mr. Freeman is also appearing for some other submitters who aren't my clients, but they are in close proximity. So it might be helpful if I introduce with legal submissions for Arthur's Point Woods Limited. Noting that they are just for that particular submitter.
At the moment, as regards to the two companies, having one plate, like obviously Mr. Freeman's going to cover both. So yes. If you start for Arthur's Point Woods, and you are solely acting for that company, and Mr. Freeman's giving evidence for both.
For both. That's right, and there are a lot of points of Mr. Freeman's evidence that overlap between the multiple submitters, but I'm sure Mr. Freeman will have that in his mind as he answers any questions.
And well, in that case, let's start with the submissions, and we'll go
to that. Sounds good. So just to introduce the team briefly, the far left, Mr. Skelton, is landscape architect. And my colleague Ms. Barry and Mr. Freeman to my right.
Barry, I-E or
Y? Y.
And your first name then?
Kelsey. K-E-L-S-E-Y. K, yes.
Well, my legal submissions were pre-circulated, so I don't propose to read them out word for word if the panel is comfortable with me just walking through some key points. So as mentioned, my client's Arthur's Point Woods Limited, and I apologise for all the acronyms that it appears occur in Arthur's Point because they're everywhere. But Arthur's Point Woods Limited owns 155 Arthur's Point Road. The Arthur's Point Woods largely accepts and is in agreement with the council on the medium density zoning of their land at Arthur's Point. So our case today is quite focused, that's summarised at paragraph 4. Part of the
case relates to the height limit. We're seeking a permitted height up to 8 metres with another tier of control, restricted discretionary, 8 to 12 metres at Arthur's Point. And then the second part of the relief is quite different, but equally as specific. It relates to the number of residential units per site, and we're seeking relief in relation to sites that are less than 250 metres squared. So I won't read out the next few pages. At the top of page 3, I've outlined the council's delineation of the Arthur's Point Northland that we're, well, the wider Arthur's Point North area we're talking about. And just to summarise my take on council's position, it's largely a concern about having bespoke zoning for this land, different to the wider medium density residential land, which is sort of the key difference of opinion, I think, between the council and Mr. Freeman. So over the page at page 4, I won't repeat or haven't repeated the legal tests, and that the council, the council's counsel has summarised those. Other than some legal submissions off the hoof, really, on the NPS, which is dangerous, and that, like the panel, potentially, I'm still getting into the NPS, but I do have it with me.
Well, that's a good start. Can I say that, I don't know if it was quite got into Commissioner McLeod's consciousness yet, but the other three of us were all separately reading it until the end. Speak personally, I have scanned it once, thought, well, that's a whole packet of issues and numbers.
Yes. It sounds like we had an equally fun weekend, sir, but and I'm conscious that
but, so, and I also appreciate that like us, you will be still in the first impression stage, I imagine.
Yes.
But we're for us, any assistance you can give in assisting us to better understand where that NPS is different from its predecessor.
Mm.
What the implications are, in particular, as you're advancing, would be appreciated. I think for our knowledge to grow.
Yes.
Well, as we talk to people, you've got to be returning, you become better fortified.
I will. Next time, that's I absolutely will be. But a few sort of high level remarks that occur to me on the NPS is that Queenstown is categorised as a tier 2 area, not a tier 1 area, which is different to say Auckland or Christchurch. And for my case today, the key take home from that is this 6-storey height limit that's proposed in city centre type zones doesn't apply to tier 2, so perhaps helpfully you can set that aside.
How many metres are 6 stories?
It's quite high.
Probably 16 to 18 metres.
I was quite alarmed when I started reading the NPS and thought that might apply in some zones in Queenstown and Wanaka, but it doesn't. So there's an objective that applies 28 days following gazetting, and so the NPS has already been gazetted, as the Commissioner has noted. Directing people, well, it's objective 3. I won't read it out word for word, but it's directing people to areas of urban development near central zones, well serviced by transport, and where there's a high demand for housing and business land. So that's objective 3. Not that I'm aware of. So I think the trigger there, however we would need to define it, would be area is in or near a central zone or other area with many employment opportunities, which I would put Arthur's Point into that category. There may be parts of the wider Queenstown Lakes that wouldn't hit that criteria. Potentially.
What is the centre zone? That's a city, like city.
Yeah, it's they're defined, and it's the trouble with the NPS is that apply zoning that all councils have different. So a centre zone is defined in the NPS as a city centre zone, metropolitan centre zone, town centre zone, local centre zone, neighbourhood centre zone. They sound to me like unitary plan terminologies for zoning.
We've already had a discussion, but there seems to have been open focus on this.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but that occurred to me as I read the definition. It seemed to be borrowing the unitary plan. So this is in the definitions section. So, and I don't sort of, it's, I don't think it's a something that you need to turn your mind to right now, but it occurred to me, for example, would a visitor accommodation overlay to a residential zone trigger that? Potentially not, in that it's it doesn't have that same commercial focus, but it could, and I don't have the answer for you on that right now. These are just my initial thoughts.
Like, at the moment, we're still accumulating questions. We're
correct, agreed, and I'm sure by the end of this hearing phase we will have those answers for you, hopefully. And with Objective 3 applying, Policy 3 doesn't apply because this isn't a Tier 1 urban environment. This is the policy about the 6 storeys minimum height, or enablement, sorry. And Policy 5, though, in my submission is quite important. Regional policy statements and district plans applying to Tier 2 urban environments enable heights and density of urban form commensurate with the greater of the level of accessibility by existing or planned active or public transport to a range of commercial activities or commercial services or relative demand for housing. So in my submission, that Policy 5 will be particularly relevant to Queenstown and Wanaka. And my very high-level summary of that would be the matching demand with infrastructure transport.
And that relates to planned public transport?
Not existing. And
so if I was to say that, you know, Wanaka will be served by public transport, that's quite a... I don't want to go there.
No, I agree, and I agree with you. And then that would... I would imagine would anticipate looking to things like LTPs and anticipated investment, making sure development is occurring around that investment. So they're the key objective and policy frameworks I consider important to my case today. Timing, I think the timing is what it is. It's happening now. It's been gazetted.
On the 21st of August.
So unless you issue a very quick decision on my case today.
I think you can proceed on the basis that you will not give the police an error before recommendation before the 20th of August.
So that's fair. So it will apply in that case. And I had my initial take is that then the district council still does have a lag time to implement this of 2 years for these intensification policies.
As I read it, the lag time relates to like the assessment, the housing right, assessment, yeah. the demand
versus supply.
But that the but the plan focus is as soon as practicable,
yep.
Which is part 4.4.1.1. So,
To things like the car, sir. To things like the car parking and density and all.
Well, effectively, the responsibility on us is to decide
there's a few ifs there for the commissioners. For the case today, it's an example of some submitter scope for you, in that we're seeking more enabled height and density in an area in close proximity to the city centre, in a landscape that the evidence of Mr. Skelton can absorb that demand, that growth.
Well, can I pose that question? Sort of, it's close to the city centre. What is close that elsewhere, I know that the doctor talking about in walking distance, Gordon said that Arthur's point was within walking distance of Queenstown Bay, except for the very enthusiastic.
There is a walking track between the two.
As I observed by other commissioners, I think it's good by fakes to walk from Northland to Wellington.
Yes, and they're not in walking distance for most of us. agreed. Although it is in the Queenstown context, it's one of the closest.
Correct.
And on a key transport corridor between Arrowtown, then Coronet Peak Ski Field through Arthur's Point into town.
So is the driving distance Arthur's Point to be closer than Franklin?
Yes, much closer, and for reasons that I don't know the answer to, so some evidence from the bar, there doesn't appear to be the same transport delays between Arthur's Point and town. So it's a relatively fast drive, I'd say 5 minutes, 5 to 7 minutes. I live just on the edge of Frankton, and it's probably more like 20 minutes Frankton to town in the morning. Along Frankton Road. So it is, in a practical sense, it is one of the closer suburbs to central Queensland. The next part of my submissions is on the legal environment, and I don't propose to read that other than to just make the comment, which I've summarised at 23 of the submissions, that due to the long-standing rural visitor zoning, the Arthur's Point North area, so that's the area delineated on that plan I referenced, receiving environment has a high-density visitor accommodation and residential node within an ONR. So the take-home from these sections, in short, is just that the environment of Arthur's Point has been modified and changed by both the development and also the granted resource consents, of which there's a couple on this site, which I'll get to shortly, which have influenced that environment compared to a blank sheet type assessment. And over the page, and under the heading Consented Baseline, I've just outlined the two key consents that sit currently live and sit over this site, and one in particular, the most recent one, which I've got here, which was granted this year, authorising 34 allotments. And 12 of those are under the 250 metre squared medium density residential lot size, which is what creates the problem for my client, and is the second part of the relief we're seeking, which is to enable a residential dwelling to be constructed on those lots.
Just to confirm the middle sentence, 26 is 8 lots, lots 1 to 12, and I detect
a number issue there.
No,
correct. I'm lucky I'm not an accountant, I'm just a humble lawyer. But the lots, and on the back of Mr. Freeman's evidence from memory, there's a plan showing the subdivision. It's 12. So that can be amended. Good spotting. And they're the, in a practical sense, the lots that cause the problem with the current rule, and that it doesn't enable a residential dwelling on those lots. Now, of course, this is just from the perspective of this submitter, and in this context, there is an 8-year duration land use consent attached to this land as well for those dwellings. So if someone was to, within the 8 years, they would have a consent to build a dwelling, but that the duration of that is capped at 8 years. So in 8 years' time, that consent, unless it was extended or varied, won't apply. So that's the background, and the remaining parts of my submissions that I'll bring your attention to are in relation to these two themes of relief. One is about the height, so this addition of a RD activity status for higher buildings, and also this density point. So the medium density residential height limit's 8 metres for both flat and sloping, and in non-compliance with that, so a 9-metre building would be non-compliant. And while my client supports the permitted height standard, we're seeking the additional, more refined, in my submission, approach of an RD activity status for up to 12 metres. And I've just given some more background over the page in relation to the history of heights in Arthur's Point, in terms of what has enabled the current buildings to be their height, of which was the rural visitor zone height limit of 12 metres. And in my submission, the receiving environment now reflects what that rural visitor zone enabled, which in many instances are 12 metre high buildings. In other words, in my submission, the ship has sailed. And I've outlined at 34 a summary of Mr. Skelton's landscape assessment as to the ability of this landscape to absorb that height limit, and I don't propose to read that out and that you're best to hear that from Mr. Skelton. It's just a summary from me. And overall, Mr. Skelton considers that a 12-metre building height on the site would not detract from the landscape character or visual amenity values. And that's a point that's also been covered off in the resource consents that have been granted on the site that have considered the effects of the development that has been granted on the ONL surrounding the site.
Did the resource consent, the land use part of the resource consent, cover the height of the buildings as well?
I can let Mr. Freeman take that question.
Yeah, the subdivision consent provided a maximum height of 8 metres, 20 metres from the northern boundary, which adjoins the R now.
But beyond that, it would have been the 12 metres.
Both consents have been issued under the ODP rural visitor zone, which enables greater height. And so the top lots within 20 metres, maximum height is 8 metres. Oh.
And
that's to be gathered by consent notice as well.
So what's that distance? 20 metres from the 20
metres. That's 20 metres from the northern or top boundary that joins the LNR.
But otherwise, 12 metres.
Yes, under that, yes.
And there's this submitter is seeking a similar control, that 20 metre setback control, from the ONL in relation to the relief sought. So it's consistent with that, the approach taken in that subdivision and land use consent. And at 38, again I won't read it out, but I've provided a summary in my submission of why the relief sought is appropriate in the context of the legal framework before you. And I've included the strategic chapters of the district plan. And I'd add to that, this is where the NPS would also, had it not been released on Friday, would have fitted into the summary here of why this relief is appropriate. And it's enabling density in an environment that can absorb it within proximity, and they're just my words, of the central city. So 39, I've summarised the case, if you like. It's submitted that the addition of an RD height of 8 to 12 metres, set back 20 metres from the ONL, is the most appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the Act, that it balances the need to protect ONR values with the need to meet urban demand. The remaining sections in relation to the height limit I won't read out. I've just summarised the Council's reporting officer's response to the relief sought, and Mr Skelton has responded to that in his evidence, and I'll let Mr Skelton speak to that. So the second part of the relief relates to density, and I've touched on it already. The notified rule is for one residential unit per 250 metres squared, and Arthur's Point Woods doesn't object to that standard, but seeks that it be amended so that sites with less than 250, and they would have had to have either been existing or got through the subdivision chapter to get to that point, are entitled to one permitted residential unit as well.
So you're not asking for a change to the subdivision
chapter,
just to the land use?
Just to the land use, yeah, and that's an important point. We're not trying to change the density in terms of minimum lot size, still 250. It's just that the expectation would be one residential unit per lot due to the historic, I was going to say quirkiness, but I don't mean that in a condescending way. Zoning that's occurred in Arthur's Point, there's quite low density lots that currently don't have residential units or consents applying to them. And it's to just provide for that historic situation. Or potentially a subdivision that was granted for a smaller lot size under the subdivision chapter in the future. But we're not seeking to amend that rule. At page 12, I've provided a high-level summary of some case law on the relationship between subdivision and land use, and some of it's potentially common sense, so I won't dwell on it, but at 50, just that the subdivision consent forms part of the legal environment in a Hawthorne sense, so that is what it is. But at 51, I've also quoted from the Kircher case that a subdivision consent forms part of the existing environment, and the effects of that subdivision consent do as well. And that includes the acceptance that in some form of development is appropriate on the subdivided site, given the inevitable effects of a future land use consent. A future land use of a dwelling are considered at the time of a subdivision consent. So it's just that the two, in my submission, can't be considered in isolation. When a subdivision consent is granted, there is a consideration given of the effect of enabling anticipated development on that site. Now, 52 and 53, I've just quoted some extracts from the resource consent decisions. They're not evidence before the panel today, but they are helpful in my submission on-site assessments of the effect of this development on the surrounding ONL. The page 13, I've got a heading density, and I've sort of covered this throughout the submissions, really, which is seeking the enablement of one dwelling on a site that already exists, or on a site that's smaller than 250 square metres. There is a small typo, I apologise, at paragraph 57, the second to last line. For a potential purchaser to then be required to get their non-complying resource consent, that should be restricted discretionary. But the submission remains that, in my submission, that would be costly and inefficient.
You're saying that the land use rule is just a restricted discretionary?
Non-compliance, is my understanding of that, is a restricted discretionary. Mr. Freeman's, I think, checking that now, but
for a subdivision that would be
non-compliant to be under 250.
It might be easier
groups. Mr. Freeman's confirmed that's right. So it is RD for the land use component of a dwelling.
Across the whole medium density.
That's a medium density rule. Yeah. So they're the two key aspects of quite discreet but quite important in my submission relief sought by Arthur's Point Woods. The remainder of, or the next portion of my submissions is just to respond to the Residents Association submission. And you'll hear from me on this tomorrow as well, and there's a scope issue in that they're seeking amendment to the ONL line, which we've already been here through stage one. And in my submission there, that's outside scope. Other than a slight quirkiness of this site, which is there's one boundary that is currently zoned rural visitor, is proposed to be zoned rural under stage three. So I do think there is scope in relation to that one boundary, and that stage three will be putting the ON, well, if the panel were to accept the 42A recommendation and the relief of my client, will be putting an ONL line down the boundary of my client's site. So it's the eastern boundary. So that would be within scope of this stage.
Oh, is your point slightly that because they didn't see a rural zoning of the land, they can't see the ONL as well?
No, my submission is that there's already the location of the ONL on this land was determined at stage one of the PDP, and we've gone through in relation to the location of the ONL in most of Arthur's Point, we've been through a few Environment Court jurisdiction hearings on stage one of that already, and the court's accepted that. So it's not so much scope, but is, in my submission, it's not on stage three of the PDP, the location of the ONL on the western and northern boundaries of this land. Well, I was going to say, Mr. Skelton, out of caution, I had Mr. Skelton address this in his evidence. So we're not, if we can't kick it for touch on a legal point, there's an evidential assessment by both counsel and in relation to this land, Mr. Skelton, regarding the appropriateness of the ONL line in this location. And there's no evidential dispute between Arthur's Point Woods and Council's landscape assessment in that respect. That's fine, sir. The remainder is just a conclusion on what I've already talked about, so I'm happy to take some questions.
Said that all
absolutely, and I've briefly acknowledged that at paragraph 19 that the environment, what relatively settled environment tests don't, well, therefore resource consent contexts. But what I would say in relation to Arthur's point is that the zoning has enabled a type of environment to be established, and in a real world sense in relation to this site, that includes the subdivision consent that's been granted, acknowledging Commissioner Robson, your point, which I agree with, that there's you're not required to include that, but it is a real world assessment which would include this resource consent. I think the other reason I've referenced the resource consents is that they provide a helpful test of what level of development is appropriate and can be absorbed on this site in a resource consenting context. And in my submission, that's helpful to your job in terms of determining what zoning is appropriate and can be absorbed on this site.
Very circular reasoning like that, because been decided that what's absorbable against the background of a very permissive ODP zone, and rather than completely in a vacuum, so that's, and this was Justice Fogarty's point, that the reason why he said Waltham wasn't applicable, because plans seek different environments to what is already existing, and which, so you can't necessarily rely. So can you take it as far as that? Like, as I understand it, under the ODP, everything was controlled.
Yes, the rural visitor zone is and was. Just still is extremely enabling, and that, in my submission, that has altered the environment of places like Arthur's Point, that now have a very urban feel, and that environment is what it is. I think my submission can only go as far as that zoning has altered the environment. From recollection, Mr. Skelton's touched on this in his evidence. In a world without that rural visitor zone, or without that existing development, Arthur's Point would be an ONL right across the developed area. So to that extent, there is a relevance of that enabled and built development to the landscape assessments that are to be carried out, and that the environment has changed. And I was pondering it yesterday, it's a similar situation for a lot of Queenstown, that if there wasn't existing urban development, then what would be appropriate for the PDP would be quite a different question in my submission.
And in terms of what the Sheriff of Sale, having said that Portland doesn't apply, is the consent that your client has obtained to subdivide the land, second consent to subdivide the land, is it likely to be exercised in a Hawthorne sense?
My instructions are, and my understanding is that that is my client's intention to exercise.
There is a
for sale sign.
Yeah.
But a future buyer might implement it. But there's no, it's not a fanciful, or the consent hasn't been applied for to create an adopted environment or anything like that. I think that the relevance of that consent is again more to show what on the evidence is considered appropriate for that site in a site specific way. And I think that's as far as that submission can really go. You're certainly not bound by it. You certainly don't have to say that a zoning that precisely matches that is the most appropriate. I do think it's a relevant matter, though, for you.
Thank you.
Very good question, in that it would be a site less than 250 metres squared, and it's...
Sometimes rules say, when plans have that sort of rule, sometimes they say other than for an access loss, utility loss or blah,
blah, blah. Yeah, no, it's a really valid point, and it's something we can consider. The intent isn't to enable that. No, that's helpful. It's good to know. I was conscious that I was taking up a lot of the slots, so that's good to know. We'll come back on that point.
Just in terms of the scope of your client's submission, the height change and the density change, are they both, is the scope of the submission to apply to the whole of Arthur's Point North and not just to the site?
Yes, that's right, yes. And that's just more for a plan integrity type. There's no reason, from my client's perspective, they're just worried about their site. And Mr. Freeman's considered the appropriateness in a wider context. But that is the submission that it's appropriate for Arthur's Point North, as it's been called by the council's reporting officer, as opposed to the wider medium density zone.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there is no official name Arthur's Point North on the planning map, so that would be determined somehow.
It would, and that's why we dug out the figure 5 for that reason, and that we were struggling to find on the planning maps or in the mechanics of the plan what status Arthur's Point North as a concept has. And it doesn't, it's not a term that is used in the map. So that figure is what the area that we're talking about.
So the Arthur's Point in that is close. The area formerly is owned.
The ODP's never going to get me out of our lives.
Well, that's one of the reasons. It's difficult in having a very
diverse
design.
Yeah.
Keep coming back to bite you. Just one legal question, if I could, and this is on the MPS, because as alluded to by a fellow person, I'm just getting across it. But objectives 4 and objective 8, which basically deal with climate change, greenhouse gas emissions, what weight do they have to weigh down through the whole thing in your, or what's the intention behind that?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I'm not sure, I haven't looked back into the select committee reports or anything on that. I can only assume that the direction that our development be near transport routes, public transport routes, etc., would have benefits for climate change, reduction in emissions.
For example, into embedded footprint or carbon
in concrete? No. So in that sense, it would just form part, in my read of it, is it's just another part of your, well, the decision making that the NPS is requiring of district plans or regional plans and district plans. It's a relatively vague objective, I would submit. I mean, it's not particularly directive compared to some other parts of the NPS, which are very directive.
Might be a more direct version of the
I didn't see any in my quick scan. No, but yeah. That's fine, we can pause and return.